this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Katisa Watun, would you make the motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move approval of the minutes from January 25th.
Representative Katisa Watun moves approval of minutes from January 25th. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Representative Kraft, were you wanting?
No, no, no.
Okay, any opposed? Motion prevails, the minutes are approved. The first item on our agenda today is House File 402 by our own Representative Bierman. Representative Bierman, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bierman moves House File 402 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And Representative Bierman, you have an amendment to the A1 amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1.
All right. And would you like to describe your A1 amendment?
Yeah, the A1 amendment is the draft that we had presented on Monday regarding mergers and how we will hopefully move forward on mergers in the future.
Wonderful. Any members, you know, obviously this amendment is a substantial addition to the bill, and it's what we'll mostly be talking about. This is getting the bill in the shape that the author would like the committee to consider it. Any discussion to that amendment? Understanding that we'll have discussion once it's adopted as well. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Bierman, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for allowing me to present House File 402. This bill is designed to do two things: protect public assets and promote better health. I believe this is a goal we all share. In my comments about the bill on Monday, I stated that we stand at another intersection where corporate health services, which underpins our delivery model, meet the public health requirements we in the legislature are bound to facilitate. And that to do this task, we need to obtain a clear vision of significant changes to our healthcare landscape brought by mergers. Mergers can affect price, accessibility, and quality care across the state. This bill will help guide us in our mission. So, Mr. Chair, that's all I have. And then we can go ahead and have discussion. This bill, as I understand it, will move to health next, and so there will be plenty of work ahead of it, but I'm anxious to hear what members have to say and their thoughts and opinions.
Thank you. And just to remind the committee, we did have Representative Bierman kind of explain his proposal in more detail when we last met. There was some public testimony to the bill. That's behind us, so we're going to move directly to member questions and discussion. Did I see you had your hand up, Representative Farr? No? Oh, Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bierman, so I heard from the Attorney General last week that if he was going to be looking at the merger, and if he concluded that it didn't violate any state statute, that he would let it go through, and then if it did, we would take a look at what those issues are. So what's the purpose of the bill? Are we creating another roadblock or creating statute that will stop this merger?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say we are doing our due diligence on public assets and making sure that, you know, we do have to wait to find the determinations of the Attorney General and go from there, but this at least gives us an option to proceed to protect those public assets if we find that protection is needed.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And any idea how long this process is going to take if this bill is implemented and Department of Health is looking at this? How long are we going to give them to assess that?
That's a very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a very good question, Representative Farr, and that is one that I'm working on actively trying to find out what sort of timeline it would take. Obviously, different sized mergers would have different requirements and different amounts of time to assess them. But I think, you know, I look at due diligence on such a merger in a transforming potential impact to our total Minnesota landscape healthcare as something that we shouldn't be in a rush to do it. We want to do it right.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really wanted to thank Representative Bierman for carrying the bill and taking the lead on doing work on this really important issue. I really view this as about far more than the merger that was discussed in our last meeting. We know that it is completely in the public interest to make sure that we have a well-functioning medical care system, healthcare system, that is available, accessible, and affordable to everyone in our state. This is critical stuff. This is life and death stuff. And not only that, but we have the charitable assets part of this. So these are mostly tax-exempt organizations who are getting an enormous tax benefit from the state of Minnesota and its people. And it really behooves us to set up a regulatory structure where we can examine whether mergers or, for that matter, transfers of charitable assets are in the public interest. And I just want to be very clear that I think Representative Bierman said it very well, and I think he's right, that there is a lot of work still to do on this. We need to get this right. We need to make sure that the agencies involved are properly resourced and able to do this work, and that we have proper oversight from beginning to end. But this is something our state needs, irrespective of this particular merger. And so I think that the merger that we've discussed is, or the potential merger, really just kind of lights a fire under us to get this going and get the right minds in the room and figure this out. Because, you know, we have this public-private system of healthcare, and we need to make sure that it does actually work in the public interest. And so I just appreciate Representative Bierman taking this on and continuing to work on it, because it's a heavy lift, and there are a lot of folks who need to be involved and have their voices heard, and I just really appreciate that he's willing to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. The two issues that I've heard in this and from yesterday, and maybe you can add to this list, but it seems to really be focused on the charitable or state assets that are involved in a healthcare merger and the competition concerns that might be raised. And both of those things are really sort of within the authority and currently statutory authority and common law authority of the Attorney General, frankly, in the expertise of the Attorney General's office. You know, the charitable assets does go back all the way to the common law powers of the Attorney General, and there's a lot of antitrust enforcement that the Attorney General's office already does. Is there some reason why the Attorney General's office is handicapped in its current powers and ability to review mergers in the healthcare space, or what's the reason for adding another agency into that mix in an entirely different review process than what we currently have with the Attorney General's office?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very good question, Representative Miska. One of the issues that I think is very pertinent to this is that, you know, the Minnesota Department of Health is uniquely situated with the data and the information that is reported and they're working on a daily basis about everything in healthcare, from, you know, the entire network that is operated and kept up and maintained to make sure that we have network adequacy. So I think they need to be included in this process, and I think they're an ideal partner for it.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. Just so I can understand better what the problem is in the status quo that you're isolating, is there some barrier that prevents the Department of Health right now from cooperating with the current Attorney General's robust review process having to do with competition issues and and public asset issues that are involved in healthcare mergers as we stand now.
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Miska, there's not anything as robust as what we do say on some of the areas of hospital moratoriums, for instance, where you cannot build a hospital without a process that is done, that is public, that is then brought to the legislature to approve a new hospital or even approve new beds. So they don't have that authority to oversight in this area. This is something truly lacking, as Chair Liebling mentioned. It is something that we do need to add in spite of this merger and just going forward.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any further questions other than to comment that it's still, I guess, a little unclear to me exactly what the problem is with the current Attorney General's review of the process. It seems like this is kind of, we're rushing to add another roadblock, maybe not necessarily a process that has been vetted out. I think it sounded to me from our previous hearing that the Attorney General is actually taking a pretty robust and careful look at this, and I'm not sure why we need to add another bureaucratic step into the mix.
Representative Cleavorn. Representative Cleavorn, I'm sorry to interrupt, but would you mind speaking into the microphone so that it's not for people so much in the room, but also for the broadcast? Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you so much. So in my work through long-term care committee and with higher education committee, I think about our hospitals that are functioning as nonprofits and the state allowing that nonprofit status. But what I'm noticing is that buildings are being transferred into real estate investment trusts, and I don't know what the oversight is for that in these systems, and we're not privy to which of these buildings may be transferred. And then the healthcare entity is responsible for liability, maintenance, and costs associated with it. And then the rents are then going into these investments that are then given another tax-deferred treatment. And I'm wondering, do we have any idea as to what these systems are doing with those charitable assets? And would that be addressed by your legislation? Or do we, and then do we have any idea, and is there a space where the investors in the real estate investment may have a conflict of interest because they also sit on the boards of these hospitals or manage our care facilities? I think, I know it's a complicated question.
Representative Bierman.
Yes, complicated. yeah. We are dealing with big business, which is healthcare. Healthcare is big business. So there are all sorts of models out there that are incorporated to serve the healthcare needs, but also turn a profit for various investors, which is fine. We just need to be aware of, you know, what is transpiring between mergers, particularly in this bill, regarding hospitals and medical facilities, and understand, you know, the impacts of those on the general health of the complete system, and how that will either help or harm. And I think having this information and having this process will help us take care of some of that. But it certainly is not going to fix all the issues of healthcare and high costs that we're faced with. And we just need to keep working on some of those other issues. It's only recently that long-term care has come under the microscope a little bit and had some control on purchasing of those facilities. So it's a big issue and one that we have to keep an eye on.
Thank you.
Representative Cleavorn.
Well, I just wonder if we have any kind of inventory as to how many of the nonprofits in our state providing health care have transferred their investments. And I don't know where we would get that information, or can we ask the Attorney General to look into that? I mean, I don't know what our purview is there, so.
We certainly could put that question to the Attorney General's office. I don't see Ms. Sales or anyone from the Attorney General's office in the audience, but we can try and follow up with the Attorney General on that question.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. That's all for me.
All right. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of background on before we got here today and maybe what got us here to this conversation. Earlier in the state's history, the University of Minnesota and the state had decided that they wanted to divest themselves of certain parts of the medical practice and certain parts of patient care, and they were looking for a suitor to come in and to take that part that the University of Minnesota no longer wanted to support. And Fairview stepped up, and Fairview agreed to assume that, and there were substantial legacy costs with that, and I'm keenly aware of that in my work in pensions in this legislature over the years. Many, if not all, of the individuals who are working for the University of Minnesota that were now moved over to Fairview employees are still eligible to, as participants in state pension plans, and it's kind of a unique situation because this is a unique situation that we are working under. I have to question in my mind if some of the issues that we're seeing for Fairview right now, I hate to keep talking about Minnesota businesses that are struggling because there's a lot of them, but Fairview at their own admission when they were here on Monday suggested that they've seen better times and that to try to help to be able to preserve the delivery of health services in the state of Minnesota, a merger is certainly in their best interest and the best interest of their patients. Now, folks can have different views on that. I understand that and different ways of arriving there. My question is, if Sanford, another nonprofit, is going to be merging with Fairview, another nonprofit, some of the issues that were raised today may not really be issues as far as divesting of assets and private corporations earning money or making money on that. So my question to Representative Bierman is, can you point me in the bill as amended to the section that says if these two parties view it to be too onerous for them to continue the negotiations on a merger, what the solution would be if Fairview becomes insolvent and has to close their door, or the assets that are under management by them right now that were divested from the University of Minnesota, as well as substantial patient base that they now serve here in the greater Twin Cities area?
Representative Driscoll, can I ask you that? I'm sorry, I don't think that I'm following the question. Could you try and clarify
the question? Sure, Mr. Chair. The question is, I would like to know in the bill where it says if this merger, the partners or individuals and the principals that are looking at the merger choose not to go forward and Fairview fails, what's the fallback plan to take care of those legacy assets that they are managing that the University of Minnesota used to have and to provide health care to the individuals in the greater Twin Cities area who rely on Fairview and their adjunct facilities to be able to provide medical and health services?
Representative Bierman.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, there is no line in the bill that would assure under circumstances where Sanford and Fairview do not come to an agreement and the bid fails to transpire. There's nothing in the bill that would fix that. That's not really what the bill is addressing. The bill is addressing coming up with a process for maybe this merger, but all future mergers to look at the impacts on the healthcare landscape in Minnesota when significant mergers such as this occur and what the impacts are for the citizens of this state and their needed healthcare.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a piece of legislation like this, although well-intended, may have some negative consequences on the principals who are involved in this type of merger. I always get skittish when the legislature or my days in local government, well, we were going to step in and try to fix things and make them better right in the middle of negotiations under a former set of rules. Because when the rules change, the partners may walk away and the state's going to need another bill or something to figure out how they're going to resolve those assets that are no longer being used or available because of a closing or a failure or a shuttering of a major medical facility that, again, is dealing with legacy assets of the state of Minnesota that the state felt it was having difficulty managing as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Doubt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. I apologize for having my back to you here. Just curious about the cost of this bill and if we've got a fiscal note, where that fiscal note is. If there is no fiscal note, what do we estimate the cost to be, Representative Bierman?
Representative Bierman, I'll just note we have requested a fiscal note. The committee staff is not completed yet, but Representative Bierman, happy to.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, thank you for the question. Representative Doubt, we will be waiting on the fiscal note. There's still a few items there trying to work through on that.
And Representative Doubt, just to add, the bill's going to the health committee. The commissioner and the agency that would incur costs would it be expected to be the health commissioner and the Department of Health.
Representative Doubt. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. I only serve on this committee, and as you know, I have an interest in the state budget, so I would like to see the fiscal notes on these bills, you know, as the bills are in our committee too, even if the budget doesn't come out of this committee's budget. I think, you know, not every legislator sits on every committee, and I would ask that we maybe put the brakes on a little bit on some of these bills. This committee has yet to see a single fiscal note on a bill that's gone through its committee, so I'd appreciate to see those in the future.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for letting me speak again. I just wanted to engage a bit in this conversation. I appreciated Representative Driscoll's comments and wanted to respond a little bit because I do think that the financial health of these systems is of great concern to everyone. But I guess what I would say is that I guess I would ask the perhaps rhetorical question, what happens if any of the health systems we have would fail? What happens if any hospital would fail financially? I mean, I don't know that we have a very good mechanism in place in the state to deal with that. But I think the alternative, if you're suggesting that either we should let people merge when they, let systems merge when they decide, or the alternative is maybe they'll fail, it's kind of strikes me as that maybe saying kind of anything goes, let them make the decision by themselves, which I guess is one position. But I think that your point is a good one, that part of the consideration here does need to be what is the financial health of each of these systems that is proposing to merge. I think some of us might disagree that the merger would actually be a financial solution even for them over the long term. So I do think that maybe Representative Bierman would consider adding to this bill, or I would just ask him perhaps if he would consider adding something about an analysis of the financial health of the systems that are involved in any potential merger and kind of what brings them to this place. Because I think part of this has to be does this look like it's something that's really likely to address their financial stability? You know, what's going to happen to the additional resources if there are any? Or, you know, I guess what I would just say ultimately is there is still a lot of work that does need to be done on the bill. And I think that the consideration you raise is a good one, but I don't think it's a really effective criticism of the bill to just suggest that this will slow it down and then, oh no, they might fail. Because that assumes that the merger is the answer in the first place, and I'm not really sure that it is, certainly not for the whole state.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to I just want to go on the record with a couple of things. One, there is a difference. While it's true, there is no mechanism right now to deal with failing hospital systems. There's no state, technically, state responsibility in that. There is a difference when the state is choosing to be involved within the middle of that transaction. That does bring on a different level of responsibility for the state if then there is failure. I think it's important to draw that distinction. And I would also say, you know, there was part of the conversation over here was talking about investors and these things. Well, these hospital systems are not for profit. These hospital systems, they do not have investors, they do not have shareholders, they do not have dividends. There is no stock options or ownership. These are nonprofit hospital systems. If there is a positive margin, that is going back into delivery of services. It's not going to shareholders or anyone else. So I think that's an important distinction here. And I would just add to the comments, you know, I mean, the Attorney General the other day, I think, gave a strong indication that he's engaged in a robust process. He already has that authority. He's very engaged. All of the parties are cooperating in that. This just feels like a very political move on an issue that, frankly, as much as I know that all of us around this table would like to believe that we are the smartest people in the room all the time, we're just not. And when it comes to this level of transaction and this level of merger, I'm just not sure that we are the right people to step in the middle of such a transaction and suggest that somehow we are smarter and know better than the folks who are dealing with these issues day in and day out. Certainly, Fairview and Sanford are more aware of their own financial situations than any of us are. And they are probably best equipped to ensure their solvency moving forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative, I do want us to move towards a vote. The people who are left on the list have already spoken once, so I'd ask them to be kind of brief in their response. I do want to give Representative O'Driscoll a chance to reply, since Representative Liebling was replying to Representative O'Driscoll. But I'm just going to ask everyone to kind of be brief as we move to a vote here, because we have a lot of people waiting for the next bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the comments of my colleague, Representative Liebling, it's encouraging to hear that we are recognizing the great stress that businesses, including medical providers and healthcare providers, are experiencing in the state of Minnesota. I will predict that this is not going to be the only merger that we're going to be seeing of substance going forward. Minnesota's landscape and way business is being conducted in this state is changing very rapidly in this state. And will maybe for the next few years, and that's going to cause more difficulty, I believe, for businesses to be able to stay in such a fragile market, that we're going to have not just healthcare providers that are going to need to be merging and doing things to be able to survive. We're going to have many other businesses that we haven't even contemplated yet that are going to be before the legislature if we enact these kinds of approaches to how we want to deal with mergers in the state of Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, and I'll be very brief. Just to the point about hospitals are nonprofits, and that we all get, we all understand. Real estate investment trusts are private equity, and they are focused on profits. And so I want to make sure that whatever assets our state has invested in, that we make sure that investment is serving the needs of Minnesotans. That's just what I want to say. And I would like to make sure that we are doing our due diligence to make sure that when these mergers do occur, that we are protecting the investments of Minnesotans. That's the goal I think Representative Bierman's bill brings forward, and that is what I'd like to see, and I'm very happy to support the bill. Thank you.
Representative Bierman, do you have any brief closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a thank you to all members for your thoughts, opinions, and I've written some things down, and good conversation on this start for this bill. Thank you.
Representative Bierman renews the motion that House File 402, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Health Policy and Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails. House File 402, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Bierman. The next item on our agenda is House File 16 from Representative Hollins. If you could come forward. As you are doing so, I will move House File 16 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Hollins, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. And thank you, committee members. This is the third committee stop, and I know there's been some overlap between the folks who have been on the other committees, so I won't go into detail about conversion therapy as I normally do. But just as a slight overview, conversion therapy includes a range of dangerous and discredited practices to try to change a person's sexual orientation. Techniques that we've heard about in previous committee stops have included electroshock therapy, berating children for hours at a time, and a pretty horrific practice called therapeutic rape. The term conversion therapy is a misnomer. It is not therapy. It's been denounced by every mainstream medical and mental health association, including the American Medical Association, the American Psychological Association, and the American Academy of Pediatrics. In fact, the Center for Victims of Torture actually has declared it a form of torture. These treatments are also ineffective. They lead to depression, decreased self-esteem, substance abuse, self-harm, and suicide. Our goal with this bill is to protect kids and vulnerable adults from experiencing this form of abuse. But it also seeks to prevent desperate and confused parents from being taken advantage of. A recent study by the Trevor Project found that $650 million is spent annually to provide conversion therapy. In prior committee stops, we've heard from people whose parents have gone into severe debt to put their kids through conversion therapy. And I want you to imagine spending $30,000 for a treatment that's not only ineffective, but that's actively harming your child. I believe it's well within our purview to regulate the use of such a discredited and misleading therapy. And so I have several experts here to testify, and I welcome a thoughtful discussion on the matter.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. We do indeed have a number of people who have signed up to testify. In order to make sure we have time to discuss the bill, handle amendments, and move forward, I'm asking all testifiers to limit their testimony to 2 minutes. We did communicate that before the hearing. The first person on the list is a familiar face, former Representative Hunter Cantrell. Come on down. Welcome back. Proceed, state your name for the record, proceed the testimony. After Mr. Cantrell will be John White.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to join you here today. My name is Hunter Cantrell, former state representative, and I'd like to begin by thanking the bill's author, Representative Hollins, for all of her hard and tireless work on this bill and for everyone who supports this bill and banning this practice. This bill is a culmination of years of refinement to ensure that not one more child or vulnerable adult will suffer from the devastating practice of conversion therapy, and that all Minnesotans are protected from the charlatans who would seek to deceive patients and families into thinking that there is some cure for being gay or that such a cure is necessary. I am gay, and being gay, trans, non-binary, and in fact every identity within our big, beautiful LGBTQ plus community is not something to be suppressed. Rather, in the spirit of love and compassion, our shared human dignity should be uplifted and protected. This is especially true within the dynamic of patient care, as healthcare practitioners should be held to the highest standards of care, given the trust the public has placed in them, and should practice based not on bias or prejudice, but in the pursuit of empowering patients to live their full, happy, and healthy lives. Conversion therapy is being practiced throughout our state to this very day and at this very moment. Fundamentally, you as a legislature have a constitutional right and legal responsibility to regulate commerce and prohibit deceitful, harmful, and to prohibit the deceitful and harmful promotion of goods and services to protect members of the public, especially children and vulnerable adults, from the deceptive and demonstrably damaging actions of conversion therapy that pose a threat to public health and safety. There is no First Amendment protection to inflict harm on others. In close, please vote yes on this bill today, so that future generations of children and their families can be permanently protected from LGBTQ plus conversion therapy in Minnesota, and that so LGBTQ plus people of all ages can know that they are perfect just the way they are. We do not need to be fixed. We deserve to be treated with dignity and with respect. And with that, members of the committee and Mr. Chair, I thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is John White, will be followed by Marcy Darden. If you could come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is J. Aaron White, and I'm a Twin Cities pastor, husband, and father of five. I speak today as a Christian minister who has sincerely held religious beliefs like many other Minnesotans, and I believe it is important to obey those convictions. This is my worldview, one that informs my life both in the pulpit as a faith-based minister as well as in counseling sessions and conversations. The conversion therapy ban you are proposing not only muzzles Christian counselors from acting in accordance with their consciences, but it also robs the client who desires biblical counseling of the opportunity to receive it. Moreover, as a pastor, this bill has a chilling effect on my ministry as I operate in all my interactions from a biblical theological vantage point. This bill will be contested because it is simply too broad. In short, it violates my right to the free exercise of religion, and it seeks to coerce my speech in a manner that violates my conscience, my deeply held beliefs that forbid me to encourage children or adults toward sterilization. Moreover, associating the counsel of the vast majority of Christian counselors and pastors with the use of harmful practices is inaccurate and largely a red herring. Biblical counselors and pastors must act in accordance with their consciences. For me, it is the freedom to provide resources and counsel that encourage health and healing and thankfulness of the body our Creator gave us. Those who wish to receive biblical counseling, youth or adult, should have the freedom and ability to obtain it. Again, this bill is dangerously broad and, more importantly, poses an illegal threat to the free exercise of religion and free speech. My conscience, like many others, is held captive to Jesus Christ and His Word, not a law of compelled speech. I do thank you for your time.
Thank you. Next is Marcy Darden, who will be followed by David Kirby. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. Macy, excuse me.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Macy Darden. I'm a queer woman, a lesbian. I'm also a third-year medical student at the University of Minnesota and a future physician. My sexuality is not a pathology. My joy is no less joyous, and my love is no less worthy. Conversion therapy is deceptive advertising. It is by no means therapeutic. To allow the unrestrained promotion of this practice is to condone the defrauding of patients and their families. I've seen the harms that can be caused by conversion therapy firsthand. When I was young, I lost a friend. I'll call him Steve. He was the kid in class who made everyone smile and who everyone wanted to play with. As we grew up, it was obvious that Steve was more fabulous than most. When he came out as gay at school, he was celebrated. No one was surprised. He was awesome. We all always knew he was special. His parents thought otherwise. His mother was a local minister in our community and sent him to conversion camp, told him that he could be cured, told him that he could be saved. He was gone for what seemed like a long time, and he never really came back. What we got back was a shell of our old friend. It was obvious to everyone that the Steve we knew was truly gone. In his place was this child who was drowned in self-loathing and self-hate, and a year later, Steve tried to take his own life. But Steve survived, and something changed. His family finally decided to accept him for who he truly was, their gay child. All of that pain, all of that suffering and self-loathing and self-hate was truly for nothing. Steve was never saved. He was never cured. What happened was that the people around him changed their minds. And that's what gives me hope, the ability for people to change their minds. If a devout and well-respected minister can change their mind and accept their child for who they are, I have hope that others can too. I ask the people that stand in opposition to this bill to change their minds. Please, please do not condone and allow for more children to suffer. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that story. Next is David Kirby, will be followed by Sydney Lowe. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony.
usually on the right side. Better adjust to the left, huh? All right. I've got to make some adjustments, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is David Kirby, doctor of psychology for almost 30 years now, treating gay, trans, and binary clients. My goal has never been to change the people I see, but to care for them deeply. I am opposed to this bill and saddened by it. First, conversion therapy is described by supporters of this bill to include shock therapy, aversive vomiting, even rape. How often would you expect a licensed professional to engage in these coercive practices, honestly? If testifiers for this bill claim to know any such licensed practitioner, have them produce names and license numbers. Will you do that in the name of due diligence? This bill is misleading. Second, the target of this bill is licensed professionals who are already governed by their board ethics, which include standards like do not harm, do no harm to clients, including torture. This bill is unnecessary. Third, this bill does not ban conversion therapy only, but slides in other therapies to outlaw as well. What therapies are these? Any treatment that does not affirm gay identity. Does anyone have a problem with this, dictating counseling goals and eradicating clients' freedom of choice? This bill is about blatant discrimination. Fourth, the goal of this bill is not primarily about banning conversion therapy, but about banning something else, a minor's right to choose what type of therapy they want and what books they want to read. Even if you have been sexually abused, you can only receive counseling that is gay-affirming. This bill cries out against the abuses of coercive therapy, but then turns around and coerces minors into one treatment option dictated by the government. This bill is dangerously hypocritical, misleading, unnecessary, discriminatory, hypocritical, and coercive. Why does this bill even exist? It is flawed at every turn. Please take a closer look at it before you pass it forward. Thank you so much.
Next is Sydney Lowe. We'll be followed by Luca Joe Garoppoli. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, committee. Hello, my name is Sydney Lowe, and I'm a queer woman and a second-year medical student at the University of Minnesota. When I hear the term conversion therapy, I'm reminded of the importance of this bill because it will prohibit fraudulent or deceptive advertising, and that is exactly what the very name conversion therapy is. Conversion therapy is not therapy, it is abuse. It is unscientific and unsupported by the medical community, disavowed by esteemed organizations like the American Medical Association. There's been no peer-reviewed evidence that shows it to be effective, and instead it has been found that youth who reported undergoing conversion therapy were more than twice as likely to report having attempted suicide and more than 2.5 times as likely to report multiple suicide attempts in the past year. In conversion therapy, youth are subject to physical, psychological, and even sexual abuse, such as with the therapist Melvin Hiscovi, 72, of Toronto. Some practitioners have even used so-called aversion treatments, such as inducing nausea, vomiting, or paralysis, and even electrically shocking children. Youth are taught to hate themselves, to feel shame towards their own identities. This is not therapy, and this is not what I have learned in medical school, and not what I will practice as a healthcare provider. How can we expect people to trust healthcare professionals while blatantly unscientific and dangerous practices are allowed to falsely advertise as therapy? The Minnesota public deserves equitable and truthful advertising, and all Minnesotans, especially our youth, deserve safe and ethical health services. As a future physician, I choose science and love. As a Minnesotan, I want to prove the phrase Minnesota nice. In the kindness and acceptance, I will show all patients, including my LGBTQ identifying ones. I have a moral and ethical responsibility to oppose any dangerous practice that will only serve to harm the diverse identities of Minnesota that should be celebrated. And so do all of you today. So please pass Bill HF-16 to protect our community and youth. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Luca Joe Grappoli. We'll be followed by Kat Roan. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
For the record, I am a pastor, Pastor Luca Joe Grappoli. Nice to see you. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson Stevenson, and committee members. My name is Pastor Luca Joel Gropley. First, I'd like to begin with addressing the gay community, that it's being propagated that Christians hate the gay community. True Christians love all people, and for that, I am distraught. That being said, this is about law and not about love. As a pastor, my desire is to connect people to God. My goal is to not see gay people straight. It's to connect all people to the heart of the Father. The outcome is not mine, it's his. Based on the author's previous testimony, I'm struggling to understand how this language will affect clergy. I'm wondering if the bill author will clarify that today. It was also stated, 81% of the people who received this counseling were religious leaders. I'd like to see some documentation to validate this claim. We hear people have been raped, waterboarded, and electrocuted in counseling. I have checked all of Minnesota and found no records. I'm not saying there isn't, I just can't find any. So again, if this is the case, it would help to provide documentation and evidence of torturous behavior, which should already be outlawed in the law. It's not wrong to request documented proof of these claims before passing such a bill. Words without proof should not be enough to pass a law. To say that I am fraud in my testimony or the book of how God converted me from a trans male of 34 years to my original design negates the fact that I exist. This is hurtful to me and to others with a similar story. I'm living proof that my claims about counseling are real and important to be accessible to all Minnesotans. For you to state these abuses occurred without proof is and of itself fraudulent. The rule of law must be applied equally. Lastly, and most importantly, my constitutional protections are being violated. The government has no right to regulate religious freedom by claiming to regulate counseling. This bill is breaking the Supreme Court of the law of the land, the United States Constitution, and the Minnesota Constitution.
I need to ask you to
know this, that the church is here for those who are hurting, and we will continue to do what is good for people in a kind and loving manner.
Next, we have Kat Roan, followed by Renee Carlson. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Representative Hollins, Chair, and committee members. My name is Kat Roan, and I am the Executive Director for Outfront Minnesota, our state's largest LGBTQ+ advocacy organization. I come to offer our support for HF16, which seeks to end the practice of so-called conversion therapy on youth and vulnerable adults in our state. This bill will build trust in our state's care providers, will bring our state in line with the clear medical and scientific consensus on this issue, and will ensure that LGBTQ+ Minnesotans are protected from harmful practices masquerading under the guise of care. Minnesota's reputation as a leading healthcare provider comes from a long history of providing innovative, effective, evidence-based care. It's been a driving force of our economy and a point of pride for our state. There is no question where the medical community sits on practices of conversion therapy. These are illegitimate, unsupported, and harmful practices that have been repudiated by every major medical organization. It is time for our laws to reflect that as well, so that when Minnesotans seek care, they can be assured it will be guided by evidence-based standards and practices. There are real economic costs to individuals and our state when LGBTQ+ youth are subjected to the harmful and aversive practices under the guise of therapy. We see this in the health outcomes, in educational attainment, and economic attainment of LGBTQ+ community members who lack supportive environments. Minnesotans across the state have spoken up to end this practice through municipal ordinances. Care providers have stepped up to provide testimonials in support of this legislation, and LGBTQ Minnesotans have identified this as a key priority for this session. Please join me in supporting HF16. I encourage you to vote to advance this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next will be Renee Carlson, who will be followed by Dr. Margaret Charmoli. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Renee Carlson. I serve as general counsel for True North Legal. Life isn't easy. We know this from the testimonies that we've heard today. And because every person's story is different, access to trusted counselors is critical for all Minnesotans. Moreover, counselors and clients should direct the conversations about a client's counseling experience, not the government. But House File 16 doesn't allow either. It stifles personal counseling goals by censoring constitutionally protected speech of licensed counselors, clients, and many others, which is likely to result in a vacuum of care, leaving patients who voluntarily seek counseling without any options. House File 16's unconstitutional discrimination based on content and viewpoint permits speech that helps a person change his or her gender identity or express same-sex attractions, yet bans speech that helps a person address unwanted same-sex attractions or gender identity confusion. A few years ago, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals struck down a Florida law with similar yet even narrower provisions than House File 16, holding it was an infringement on constitutionally protected speech under the First Amendment. House File 16's consumer fraud provision is the most expansive counseling censorship bill in the country. The vague and overly broad language causes great concern for Minnesotans of diverse faith backgrounds. It pins them between liability under the law and strong moral convictions. Under the proposed bill, faith-based organizations engaging in faith-driven activities could be subjected to severe legal consequences and ruinous lawsuits. And it is not necessary, as current Minnesota law already holds licensed professionals accountable. There's no justification for legislation that violates Minnesotans' freedom of speech in a very private setting, while imposing severe legal consequences for Minnesotans who simply want to live consistent with their deeply held beliefs. Thank you.
Next, we have Dr. Margaret Charmoli, followed by Trevor Rubenstein. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Hello, Chairperson Stevenson and members of the committee. First of all, congratulations on your disclosure today, Representative Stevenson. My name is Dr. Margaret Charmoli. I'm a licensed psychologist who is here to testify on behalf of the Minnesota Psychological Association in conjunction with the American Psychological Association. We support House File 16 to ban conversion therapy. Psychologists are primary arbiters of what constitutes psychological disorders as well as effective therapy. Our understanding of sexual orientation and gender identity has evolved for over 50 years as a result of scientific research, clinical observations, and study. Our position is that lesbian, gay, bisexual, and or transgender people do not suffer from a psychological disorder or mental illness. As such, it doesn't require treatment to change it. Furthermore, conversion therapy or efforts to change sexual orientation or gender identity are unlikely to work and are associated with harm and serious risks, including but not limited to suicide attempts and completions, depression, anxiety, and substance abuse. We understand that some people have more fluid sexual orientations or gender identities that may evolve naturally over time, but not as a result of willful shifts or attempts to change. For the purposes of this committee, therefore, the purpose and the promise of conversion therapy is fraudulent and based on false and deceptive premises, beliefs, and information, and it is harmful. It is unethical for psychologists to render services under those conditions. To be sure, House File 16 does not prevent licensed mental health providers from talking with their clients about sexual orientation or gender identity. It only requires that they practice according to acceptable standards of care. For psychologists, that includes affirmative approaches that help people explore their options, understand the stress of being part of a marginalized and stigmatized group, develop positive coping skills, nurture resilience, seek social support, and get accurate information about sexual orientation and identity.
I need to ask you to conclude your testimony.
I will. These approaches have been shown to be effective, evidence-based practices that are associated with positive outcomes in therapy. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier is Trevor Rubenstein, followed by Seal Dwyer. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chairperson Stevenson. My name is Trevor Rubenstein. The practices that Representative Hollins mentioned are reprehensible and should not, and should be stopped, but this bill is not the correct way of doing it. Earlier was mentioned when this bill was originally presented that 81% of all of the individuals involved with conversion therapy was done by religious leaders. Being a Jewish man who's also a Christian minister, I'm very sensitive to when something seems to be moving towards a form of religious bigotry. That's not the only form of bigotry that concerns me out of this. When this is to quote Representative Hollins when she presented this bill, she said, "We must move past the idea that queer people can choose their sexuality and gender identity. Choices available to any people group excluding the queer community." I'm not talking about an individual's inclination. I'm concerned about the right to choose. It becomes incredibly dangerous when we start to take a personal choice rights away from specific groups. People within many communities are given the right to choose their sexual gender and identity and find assistance in doing so. So why are we excluding it from this specific people group? Thank you.
Next, we have Seal Dwyer, who will be followed by Jennifer Bakalov. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
My name is Seal Dwyer. Thank you for having me. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in private practice in St. Cloud. I serve primarily the LGBTQ community, and specifically I serve people with trauma. As a therapist, I'm required to use evidence-based practice, which means that I have to know that the treatments that I'm using with my people work and are backed by evidence. Conversion therapy is fraudulent and unethical and is not backed by evidence. The evidence is that it doubles suicidality. Unlike gender-affirming care, which reduces suicidality by 73%. In addition to being a licensed marriage and family therapist, I'm a board-approved supervisor for marriage and family therapy for the licensed professional counselors and the licensed professional clinical counselors in the state of Minnesota. Part of my job is to train the next generation of clinicians. As that role, I have three duties. My primary duty is always to the clients. My second duty to train the next generation of counselors, and my third duty is to protect the practice. Conversion therapy violates all three. It is clear that a practice that increases suicidality does not protect the clients. It is clear that a practice that harms our clients does not protect the interns in the next generation. And to promote this kind of practice or to allow practitioners to do this kind of practice harms the profession. Please support House File 16 and protect the queer kids in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Jennifer Bakalov, followed by Emily Pyle. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Bakalov, and my adjectives are hot and sharp. Then the Lord said, "I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I have heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. I know, however, that the king of Egypt..."
A little bit back from the microphone.
Yes. "I know, however, that the king of Egypt will not let you go except by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders. The Lord told me to speak here today because he has a message for you. The Lord says, I dare you to pass this bill because I'm getting ready to unleash my wonders in the state of Minnesota and more specifically among people currently enslaved in the LGBT lifestyle. God says to you, pass this bill, and when you do, that will trigger a move of God that will consist of a mass exodus. People currently enslaved in the LGBT lifestyle, they will exit and become people fully devoted to God. Thank you."
Next is Emily Pyle, who will be followed by Nate Oilo. Please come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Emily Pyle, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Trevor Project, the world's largest suicide prevention and crisis intervention organization for LGBTQ youth. In Minnesota, we served over 3,900 contacts last year, which we estimate is just a portion of about 32,000 LGBTQ youth in Minnesota who seriously consider suicide. To further our mission of ending LGBTQ youth suicide, Trevor is dedicated to seeing the end of practices commonly referred to as conversion therapy. We stand with every reputable medical and mental health organization in condemning these practices as harmful, ineffective, unethical, and founded on unscientific theories that have been debunked for decades. At Trevor, we have direct experience and extensive research observing the dangers of these practices. In our 2022 national survey, which reflects responses from more than 30,000 LGBTQ young people, we found that 6% reported experiencing conversion therapy, and another 11% reported being threatened with it. Those youth who either experienced or were threatened with conversion therapy were more than twice as likely to report a suicide attempt in the past year. Our counselors don't ask about conversion therapy directly when a youth calls us in crisis, but in the last year, 1,300 contacts from more than 600 cities across the U.S. explicitly raised the topic themselves. And finally, these practices also have drastic financial impacts on families and our country. In 2022, a peer-reviewed journal of the American Medical Association used health economics to find the annual direct cost of conversion therapy in the U.S. to be $650 million. Worse, the indirect costs associated with conversion therapy, like treating depression, suicide attempts, etc., totals more than $8 billion. Thank you so much for taking up this important issue and acting to protect young people from these dangerous practices.
Thank you for your testimony. The last member of the public who signed up to testify is Nate Oilo. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
Hello, my name is Nate Oilo. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I oppose this bill. As an adolescent, I experienced same-sex attractions. Knowing that homosexual practice was inconsistent with my religious faith, I chose to explore my options with the help of qualified mental health professionals and pastoral caregivers. I was not forced, I was not coerced, and I was not abused. I was honored and loved, and that I was given the power of choice and the dignity to think for myself. In addition to professional and pastoral help, I also benefited from many books, curricula, and conferences that supported my desire to bring my same-sex attractions into agreement with my religious faith. 25 years later, I still look back fondly on all the resources that were available to me, all of which set me up for the life I wanted to live. All of these resources cost me money, which I gladly paid. Counselors, religious leaders, and authors all deserve adequate compensation for the services they provide. I find it terrifying that we're actually at the point of banning books and restricting speech based on religious point of view. Why are we taking away the power of choice from Minnesotans? To be clear, no one on either side of this issue supports physical or sexual abuse, extreme shaming, or coercion as a means to help people with same-sex attractions. But there are many in the state who have found freedom from unwanted same-sex attractions and who are now enjoying marriage and family or celibacy. And I stand with and for each one of them. We want our stories to be heard. We are from Minnesota too. We want to write books to sell. We want to be compensated for sharing our stories at events. We desire the same freedoms and protections afforded everyone else. I also stand with and for every Christian, Jew, and Muslim faith leader who believes in a traditional view of marriage, family, sex, and sexuality. We promote transformation because our religious books promote transformation. To take away the power of choice and our right to information, in my opinion, is by definition abuse. Thank you.
That concludes the list of people who have signed up to testify. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on the bill? Seeing none, we'll turn to amendments. We have one amendment to take up. It's the A13. I believe Representative Miska, you were offering the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hollins. The A13 amendment is drafted really to highlight what I think are some pretty significant legal federal constitutional problems with the bill as it's currently drafted. What we as a state can do is regulate conduct and harmful conduct. We can regulate fraud, but what we cannot do under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is to regulate or censor particular viewpoints or content, engage in content-based regulation of speech. And so I'm concerned that the way the bill is drafted right now is the definition of conversion therapy is very overly broad in a way that does set the state of Minnesota up for potentially a successful legal challenge on First Amendment grounds. And one of the testifiers did reference a case from the 11th Circuit, Otto versus City of Boca Raton, Florida. And I would encourage the author or anyone interested in digging into the potential legal concerns around this bill or the potential ways that a lawsuit might play out in the 8th Circuit to read that case. It is the 11th Circuit. It is not the 8th Circuit, but I think in my reading of it and the relevant 8th Circuit case law is that this is a pretty good example of how the 8th Circuit is not guaranteed but likely to resolve the questions around this. So the A13 amendment tries to raise two ways that or two drafting issues in the bill that are ways that it might be improved and in order to insulate the state of Minnesota from potentially costly lawsuit. The first is the idea of focusing more on conduct versus focusing on speech. The way that the current definition of conversion therapy is written, it includes any practice, and then it has a bunch of terms in it that refer to the intent of the people engaging in the practice, that what seeking to change, efforts to, does not seek to. That kind of language, I think, is going to signal to the courts that that the definition includes just pure speech and based on the content or viewpoint of the speech. So I would encourage the bill author to look at ways to tighten that up. And the second issue, I think, is the way that the consumer fraud statutes are being amended in Section 3 of the bill. It adds a subdivision 7 to Section 325F.69. It's really mostly the legitimate or the potentially constitutionally viable part of that additional language is already contained in subdivision 1 of 325F.69, which bans any use or employment of a fraud, false pretense, false promise, false guarantee, misrepresentation, false or misleading statement, or deceptive practice to sell merchandise. The definition of merchandise in that statute does include both goods and services. And so what's added in Section 3 to existing law is a bunch of language calling out a particular viewpoint or particular content as fraudulent. And so I think that is also really putting the state of Minnesota in a tough position defending a First Amendment lawsuit. I don't think that this committee hearing today is the productive way to have that discussion necessarily or to do that work. So I'm not offering the A13 amendment, but the purpose of the A13 amendment is just to make sure that those concerns are highlighted. I think that the bill as written sets the state of Minnesota up for a federal constitutional lawsuit that, again, very likely to lose. It's a federal civil rights lawsuit that will enable the plaintiffs to get attorney's fees from the state of Minnesota. This, I think, is going to be a recurring theme of my concerns with bills this session, but that's the concern that's meant to be highlighted by the A13 amendment. But, Mr. Chair, I withdraw the A13 amendment.
Representative Niska withdraws the A13 amendment. There, I believe, are no other amendments being offered, so I'm looking over at the – I don't see any, so we will move to discussion. Discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank you, Representative Hollins. We've had pretty extensive conversations about this night, and I really appreciate your time and your genuine concern on the bill. And I really appreciate you being willing to listen to mine. I really do. Sorry, I'm already emotional. I don't intend to be, and I apologize for that. I have expressed concerns. You know, we talked at the last committee stop. There were several references to paid services, and we've talked about trying to find a way, and this is an amendment that I withdrew today, trying to find a way to ensure that is a limiting factor. You know, one of the concerns that I raised is, you know, But if you have a family member, I mean, where this is defining a mental health practitioner or a mental health professional, but if you have a family member who is talking to their niece or nephew and they would say something or offer advice or whatever that might not be in line with this, does that then get them in trouble? Or the same could be said for clergy. That would be a concern for me, that it's not, I want to ensure that there's protections for those things. You know, I also have some concern about the gender identity language, only because there is good evidence, as we've talked about, that, you know, there are a lot of young people, and we're seeing more and more, a lot of young people who do struggle with gender identity. But what we are finding and what the data shows is that often, as those young people particularly work through that process, many particularly young people find at some point that gender identity is not really their issue. Maybe they're just gay, but they're working through these things. And I'm concerned that this language might limit the healthy psychotherapy that can take place to help people work through those things. On the flip side, as I have indicated, I really, really appreciate the fact that this bill is now limited to minors and vulnerable adults. And I hold the very consistent position that we should not mess around with children. I hold the position that 13-year-old girls should not be able to be sterilized, and 15-year-old kids should not be subject to conversion therapy. You know, and as I offered in a previous committee, you know, a child also should not be subject to medical gender transition. We should not mess around with kids. And those are my concerns. Again, I really appreciate, Representative Hollins, your willingness to spend time with me on this and work through some of this stuff with me on this. I am going to support the bill today, as we've sort of talked about some of those things and what might be possible. I don't know if I will continue to support it in this form, but just I really appreciate your willingness and openness to have these conversations.
Thank you, Representative Brindley. Further discussion to the bill? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins. A couple of questions related to Representative Brindley's comments. I understand that the section 1 and 2section 1 and 2 of the bill right now are limited to children and vulnerable adults. The section 3, is that limited in the same way? It doesn't read to me as being limited to conversion therapy targeted at minors and vulnerable adults. Am I misunderstanding something there?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Representative Niska. My understanding is that it is, in general, it's to the regulation of all conversion therapy. You know, of course, particular, we are concerned with vulnerable adults and children, but when you're looking at advertising, if you're advertising conversion therapy, brought, just like cigarettes, right? Like, you might not be targeting children by advertising cigarettes, but if kids are seeing cigarettes being advertised, then that's something that they are then being advertised to. So I don't think there's a good way to limit advertising restrictions to just kids and vulnerable adults.
Representative Niska.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. That's kind of the way I was reading it as well. A different question. There has been discussion about talk therapy, and that's just something that's discussed a lot in the cases about similar kinds of bans. Can you explain sort of how peer, you know, just how does this definition of conversion therapy apply to just a counselor and a patient sitting and speaking and doing nothing other than speaking?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska, for that question. So this actually brings me to something that I had made note of that I wanted to bring up, because I think there's a lot of concerns here around how this might affect especially religious organizations and pastoral care. So in the bill, in subdivision 2, I think of section 1, it does say mental health professional and mental health practitioner, which does have their own definitions within the state statute. And I have them pulled up, and I won't read the entire thing, but the long and the short of it is it requires 4,000 hours of work within the scope of the mental health care. And a lot of it has graduate training requirements as well. So when we're looking at this, we're really talking about, in particular, those individuals that are trained and licensed to be mental health professionals and mental health caregivers, not your pastor, not somebody who you might have a relationship with and you have questions about, you know, questions regarding their experience or what they want to talk to you about. I really appreciate Representative New Brindley bringing her concerns to me about this in particular. I do believe that, you know, my understanding of this when I've talked to other professionals in the realm of mental health, I am by no means a mental health expert, but I am a lawyer. And as you know, as a lawyer, just because we give advice to somebody doesn't mean that we are engaging in a, you know, attorney-client relationship, right? I mean, there has to be an established relationship that then we are in this situation where we are related to each other. So in the same vein, you know, if you're a counselor and you happen to know somebody who is going through something, you say, oh yeah, this has happened before, you know, you're talking it through, that doesn't necessarily mean that you are engaged in a client-professional relationship. And so I don't think that this law would apply in that situation.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. I think for one clarification of at least your intent, I do think there probably is some work that could be done to tighten up the definition of any practice by to make sure that it's within that type of a relationship. But so that's helpful. There was a different part of my question that maybe wasn't very clear, and so I was also trying to understand within that context of that relationship, and I appreciate that it only applies to certain types of defined practitioners, but within that relationship, if the practice between the practitioner or mental health professional and the patient consists entirely of just them talking, the term that's used a lot is talk therapy, that's what I was trying to understand is some clarity on the record as to whether just talking in that context could fall within the definition of conversion therapy.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. I'm sorry. I probably jumped ahead to the thing I wanted to answer and not to what you actually asked, and that's my fault. So, yes, just talk therapy would apply in this situation. The definition of conversion therapy is pretty broad, and we've been talking about the stuff that's on the sort of furthest end of it, but also recognizing that when folks enter into an agreement to do conversion therapy to experience that, when we talk about talk therapy, it's less of a sort of give and take traditional therapy, and more, from my understanding, it's more of like an intense berating sort of situation. So it's not what we would consider traditional therapy. Now, one thing I will say is that I think there's this notion that the opposite of, or what we are trying to get to is gay affirming, and I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think that there is a space, a gray area, that says we are affirming who you are as a human being and how you want to deal with that. And I think one of the testifiers gave a great example of that, talking about what it means to be part of a minority community, sort of coping mechanisms for that, and just exploring really how you feel about it and what you want to do. And I think that's really sort of the difference between saying like, hey, everybody should be gay. That I don't think anybody's saying that, right, in their therapy. But we also don't want them to say everybody needs to be straight.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hollins, I appreciate the answers. I do think that that's really kind of the nub of where, and I if I was understanding your nonverbal communication, I'm guessing you have looked at some of the case law on this. I would encourage you to try to tighten up the definition somewhat. There is at least a difference of opinions in federal courts about whether just pure talk therapy ban in this context runs afoul of the First Amendment. I expressed my opinion about what I think the Eighth Circuit is likely to do if the law as it's currently written is challenged. But I do think there's some, even taking the way that you described your intent of the bill, I do think there's some additional work that could be done on the definition. So I encourage you to do that. Thanks.
Representative Hogarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hollins, question for you. Again, going back to lines 2.1 through 2.6, the area that we are kind of discussing right now. And just to clarify for legislative intent, is it possible that, I mean, it's possible, but I want to know within the context of the proposed legislation, if a pastor or someone who's providing pastoral care also happens to be a mental health professional, a licensed mental health professional, how would that be resolved? Are they going to be judged as a pastor providing pastoral care, or are they going to be judged under this as a licensed professional when they actually possess both, or practicing, if you will, in both professions?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. That is part of the conversation that I've been having with Representative New Brindley, and you know, I'm really committed to working on the language to maybe define the patient professional relationship within that context, so that we have some clarity on that situation. Because I mean, yes, potentially that could become an issue, right? And we would not want to, I mean, certainly, like, this was drafted with the intent of not infringing upon anybody's religious freedoms, because that is an important aspect of everything that we do here, and we want to make sure that we stick with that. So that's something that we're certainly considering, and we were just speaking about it a couple of minutes ago, but, you know, I'm committed to trying to make something work on that.
Representative Driscoll.
And then just to kind of put a different look at that from in the prism, what happens if you were licensed but are no longer licensed, and someone comes to you and asks you questions in the situation of another contact? You happen to be a neighbor, you happen to be a friend. Hey, I know somebody that used to be in this business. Maybe you want to visit with them. Would they also be covered as someone who was previously licensed under the guides of what we're looking at? Would they be qualified, or do you have to be an active licensee in order to fall under the confines of what you're trying to accomplish here?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Ooh, that's beyond my pay grade. I would have to look a little closer at the statute and the licensing requirements for that. I don't know if any of my testifiers have a good sense of how that would apply if you were previously licensed. My understanding of your question is, if somebody's previously licensed, is no longer licensed, are they still considered a licensed practitioner? My inclination would be no. No. Okay.
And Mr. Chair. For what worth, it seems to me that subdivision 2 is written in the present tense, that you'd have to be a practitioner for the prohibition to apply. So at least my view would be consistent that someone who does not currently hold a license is not currently a practitioner, does not fall within the prohibition of subdivision 2. Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and that's what I just wanted to say for legislative intent, because this is something that we're trying to work on. At the bill author's suggestion, we don't want to infringe on religious rights and things. And as people may endeavor to be in one profession or change to another or have multiple professions, I think it's something that we need to take a look at. And I appreciate the author's willingness to work with others, including someone as steep in this as Representative New Brindley and her care and concerns about this as well. So thank you for that.
See no further discussion. Representative Hollins, would you like to make any closing remarks?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. I want to thank the committee members for a really good and thoughtful discussion, and very, you know, kind and grounded in, you know, good stuff. My words are failing me, but I really appreciate that. And I want to thank the testifiers that came here today, all the testifiers that took time out of their day to be here. It's not easy to come down to the Capitol and talk about things that are so personal but I really do appreciate it. And I really wanted to thank former Representative Hunter Cantrell for paving the way for this legislation and, frankly, paving the way for many of us queer legislators to be as unapologetically honest about ourselves and our identities and empowering us to fight for the needs of our communities. It's truly an honor to carry this legislation and to carry on Representative Cantrell's legacy and to fight for the more than 200,000 queer people who call Minnesota home. This bill is really important, and it's long overdue. So I would encourage a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. And I would echo your thanks to this committee for a very thoughtful and discussion today. I appreciate that. I will renew my motion that House File 16 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 16 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. We've concluded our agenda for today. I'm looking over at Representative O'Driscoll to see if he has a question.
It is that time of the week, isn't it, Mr.
O'Driscoll.
Chair? I bet you can read my mind, so I'll just let you have a shot at it.
All right. I'll ask members of the gallery to... Thank you. Next week, I think we will have bills, excuse me, on both Monday and Wednesday. On Monday, we'll be taking up, in all likelihood, we haven't posted yet, so reserving the right to make changes, but my intention at this point is to take up a bill by Representative Tabke. I've shared the bill number with you. It relates to motor vehicle warranties and a bill that I've authored relating to electric vehicles. I didn't have a bill in this committee this week. I was feeling left out, so I've come back next week. And on Wednesday, I expect us to take up a bill from the majority leader on the Minnesota Care buy-in. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With no further business, the meeting is adjourned.